How's that?
I think
one day I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that was the case?
Oh, no. So, that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day
I will never accept
it. Was
that.
Like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And
look, I don't know. It's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Ian Chappell comes from an era when cricket was fun and colourful and controversial. He was born into a family with a rich history in the game, and eventually he became captain of the Australian team, just as his grandfather did and his brother would do. As anyone could see in that recent TV drama, How's That?, Ian Chappell played a central role in Kerry Packer's breakaway World Series cricket phenomenon, even if Ian thinks they didn't quite get his character right in it. He's seen plenty of glory on the pitch, and he's seen some legendary Australians right up close where their flaws become visible. And although he says he was often boiling with barely suppressed rage on the pitch, Ian has also had so much fun in an action-packed life. He's put out a book of his stories called Chappelli, Life, Larrikins and Cricket. Hello, Ian. Welcome.
Thanks, Richard.
Your mum, the daughter of Victor Richardson, the mother of three Test players. I hope she enjoyed cricket, Ian.
Yeah, she didn't. I actually used to think she just got dragged around by Martin, our father, to cricket matches. But when he died, and he died a long time ago, 84, I think, she still kept going to cricket matches. So I suddenly thought, well, maybe it wasn't just Martin dragging her around. She probably did like it.
It wasn't just loyalty. It was a real pleasure in the game.
Yeah, a lot of it was loyalty, obviously. It's interesting. I asked her many years after I'd retired. It suddenly dawned on me how daunting it must have been for a mother to sit there and watch her three sons, particularly in an era of no helmets. And I thought it must have worried the life out of her that one of us might get killed by a cricket ball. And I asked Jean, I said, Jean, did you worry about it? She said, no. I said, why not? And she said, I don't know. I just didn't worry about it. Now, whether Martin had convinced her that, you know, we were okay and we wouldn't get hit, I'm not sure. She didn't admit to that. But, I always thought that would be a terrible thing for a mother to worry about, but she didn't seem to worry about it.
Your dad was a pretty driven sort of guy. Who are you more like, do you think, your mum or your dad?
You know, a few years ago, I came to the conclusion I was more Richardson than Chappell. And that came about because I obviously... Yeah, I had the good fortune to, I was about 26, 27 when Vic died in 69. So I had the good fortune to spend a bit of time with him and enjoyed his company and admired him greatly. But I read a lot more about him after I'd stopped playing. And Ray Robinson's book, On Top Down Under, I read a bit about him there and his captaincy and his style of captaincy. And there were a couple of things that he did. And I just chuckled to myself and I thought, that's where it came from. But he, you know, I mean, things like they were playing New South Wales. Vic was captain and opening batsman. And I think Slinger Nitzky was the other opening batsman. And they got New South Wales out late in the day. And you can imagine what sort of a side New South Wales had in those days. You know, they had Bradman, McCabe, they had everybody. And so... South Australia going into bat late in the day and it's quite dark and overcast. And in those days, you could actually appeal against the light as a batsman. So Vic said to Slinger, as they're walking through the gate, he said, don't ask any questions, just follow me. And Vic started heading off towards the showground instead of towards the pitch, you see. And one of the umpires yelled out, hey, Vic, where are you going? And I think Tommy was the umpire. And he said, oh, Tommy, I can hear you, but I can't see you. Well, you yell out again, you know. And they got the light. I don't think they even faced a ball and they got the light. And, you know, I read stories like that and I think there was an aha, that's where it came from.
Oh, there's a larrikin streak in him that you share in that sense with Vic Richardson. You actually tell the truth of that story, that famous story during the Bodyline series when Vic was vice-captain at the side. And... amazingly, the English manager came to the Australian dressing room demanding an apology from the Australians. What's your understanding, as you heard it from your grandfather, of what followed from that?
Well, it was a pretty momentous day. I mean, that was a momentous series, the Bodyline series, but it was a momentous day because early in the day, Woodfull, who was the captain, had been hit over the heart by Larwood and he, you know, left the field, retired hurt. And then later in the day, Bertie Oldfield went to hook Larwood, got a top edge and, you know, he got a fractured skull. And apparently actually said on the field, you know, when Harold came up to him and apologised and Bertie Oldfield said to him, Harold, it's not your fault. You know, it's my fault. I edged it. But you can imagine, and Bill O'Reilly told me many years later that he said if that had happened in Melbourne or Sydney, he said they'd have been over the fence. And he said if one person had come over the fence in Adelaide, they'd have all come. So it was obviously, you know, there was tremendous tension around that day. After play, there was a knock on the Australian's door, and Vic happened to be near the door, and he opened the door, and it was Pelham Warner, Plum they used to call him, Pelham Warner, and he said, is Mr. Woodfull there, please? And Vic said, no, he's on the table getting some treatment. What do you want? And Plum Warner said, I want an apology from the Australian who called Larwood a bastard. And Vic turned back into the dressing room and he said, which one of you blokes mistook that Larwood for that bastard Jardine? You know, which, and they messed it all up in the movie and in the novel, because the original quote was much better than what they used.
He played alongside Don Bradman. And how did they get on? Did you sort of see how they got on firsthand?
Well, when you go to a party, you know, family function or something like that, Vic was a great storyteller, but he would tell stories more about cricketers or people rather than cricket. And he didn't talk much more. He hardly ever talked about himself unless he was in the story.
So he wasn't one to recount old war stories then?
Well, about cricket about matches, but it was more people, to do with the people than the actual, guy took 5 wickets and that bloke made 100 that day. Anyhow, if anybody ever asked him about Bradman, he would say, great batsman. And I got to know as I got a bit older that was the point where you stopped asking any more questions about Bradman. You know, I heard obviously from my mother, who my mother has had plenty of opinions and she was quite prepared to state them. And I knew what Vic thought of Bradman because Jean had told me many times, and she certainly told me what she thought of Bradman, and none of it was very complimentary. But I got the feeling that Vic also didn't want to say anything about Bradman in front of me or any of the boys, because he wanted us to make up our own mind about Bradman.
You didn't want to prejudice your opinion.
Exactly. Yeah. But little did he know that his daughter was white-handing him badly, because we heard quite a lot what she thought of Bradman. But then one night, the headmaster of Prince Alfred College, where the three of us went, he played Test cricket for New Zealand. And when New Zealand were in town playing against South Australia, he invited both the teams to his house, the headmaster's house at Prince Alfred College. And he also invited a few ex-players and dignitaries. And Vic was at the party. And I'd been talking to a whole lot of other people. And I saw Vic walking out the door. And he was walking out with Bradman and Alan McGilvray, the ABC radio cricket broadcaster. And I suddenly thought, I haven't spoken to Vic. I better say goodnight to him. So I was coming up behind Vic as they were walking out. And I heard Bradman said to Vic, it's great that your old mate Arthur Gilligan got the presidency of the MCC. And Vic said, yeah, it is good, because Arthur and he used to broadcast together a lot. He said, yeah, it's great. He said, just as well they don't have the same system in Australia. And Bradman said, what do you mean? And he said, well, in the MCC, all your mates vote you in. He said, if they had the same system here in Australia, you wouldn't get a vote, you little And so I stopped dead, and I'm thinking, well, I don't think Vic will want me to know that I've heard this, you see. So I turn around, and he died never knowing that I'd heard it. And a year or two after he died, I was having a drink with McGilvray, and I told him, recounted the story. And he said, how did you know about that? And I said, well, I was walking up behind Vic, and he didn't know that I was there, so I heard it myself. So I got to know right near the end of his life exactly what he thought of Bradman.
How driven a man was your father? There's three sons here, and he was him that pretty much taught you to play cricket early on, wasn't it, your dad? Was he driven that you should all become test players?
Martin had a grand plan. He was a very good club cricketer. You know, like a lot of people born in 1919, he missed 7 of his best years because of the war. Looking back on his career and his figures and so on, he probably would have played maybe a handful of Shield games because South Australia, weren't over strong, and he was a decent club batsman. But he loved the game. He also played baseball. He played Claxton Shield baseball for South Australia as a catcher. So he had this grand plan. He told me, well, I don't know what age I was, but he said, you'll bat 3, Greg will bat 4, and Trevor will open the batting. And he said, wow. And in the winter, he said, you'll catch, Trevor will pitch and Greg will play shortstop, I think it was. And that's, I mean, Trevor pitched in his younger days. He stopped pitching later, but I caught and Greg played shortstop, as did Trevor later on. And he had this grand plan. I don't think it was part of his grand plan, but he organised for us to go to Prince Alfred College. So the three of us went there. And they had a brewery right across the road from Prince Alfred College. So for about 250 days of whatever, 5 years, I think I was there, I had the smell of hops wafting across on the breeze across the college. Little did I know, and little did Martin know, that this was perfect training for touring with Walters and Marsh for many, many years.
Gave you a tolerance.
Exactly. Right. But the thing I remember distinctly, we went out to the Unley Oval. I was five, and Martin was playing in a club game at the Unley Oval. And he said, "Come with me, son." And we walked up the stairs to the top, to the back of the grandstand, and there was an old guy there, and he said, "Meet Mr. Fuller, Ian." So I, how do you do? His name was Lynn Fuller. And he said to Lynn, "When should I start to get Ian coached?" And he said, "How old is he now?" And Martin said, "He's five." He said, "Bring him around next Sunday." So for every Sunday of the summer, and summer I'm talking sort of probably October through to March, maybe into April, every Sunday of the summer I would go around to Lynn Fuller's and be coached by Lynn. He would, I don't know how old he would have been, probably well into his 50s, maybe even 60s when I was going around there. And from age 5 to about 17 every Sunday, and Lynn would bowl for an hour at us. And then Greg follow on. He was too old when Trevor came along.
You were five?
Five, yeah.
What was he bowling at you?
He used to bowl little medium paces. He may have started just tossing the ball to me at five. I'm not sure. But around about 9 or 10, Martin started to throw balls after we'd had the session with Lynn. He'd say, "Right, stay there." And he would then toss half volleys and full tosses and loose deliveries. And he'd say, "It's fine about staying in this game," he said, "but the idea of this game is to score runs. You've got to learn how to deal with the loose ball." And then at around about 9 or 10, he said, "Stay down there, son." And Lynn's pitch, he had an actual pitch in the backyard. It was half the distance. So it was an 11-yard pitch of turf. And then you got onto the actual ground. And because he'd been top-dressing the pitch, there was a rise at the halfway mark. And with the heavy roller going on, it was a nicely rounded rise at the halfway mark. And Martin, you know, he'd been a state baseball catcher, so he had a decent arm, and he's just started running in and throwing balls off this rise and basically said, "Come on, son, you've got to learn to defend yourself." So I'd, all I'd ever been taught was how to hook and pull, and no one ever said anything about ducking. So I remember this horrendous night I had. I'm playing in a Shield game at 18 against Wes Hall, and it's like, might have been 1.5 seasons after the Tide Test Series in 60-61. So Wes is at his peak and very fast bowler. And I'm suddenly lying there the night before this Shield game against Queensland, and I'm thinking, what do I do if Wes Hall's too quick to hook? You know, I've never been taught how to duck or anything like that. I hope he's not too quick to hook. And so I've gone out there with no plan B or anything to face Wes Hall. Anyhow, the first bouncer he bowled me, he went wide on the crease. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then a few balls later, wide on the crease again, another bouncer. So he's bowled about four of these bouncers, all from wide on the crease. And I'm thinking, this is fine. You know, every time he goes wide on the crease, it's a bouncer. So I'm laughing here. Anyhow, about an over later, he's close to the stumps, you see. And I'm not thinking bouncer, but it was a bouncer. And as I've sort of tried to hook it and sort of half fallen over, it's flicked the peak of my cap, and Wally Grout was the keeper in Queensland in those days, and I was never been so delighted to hear the smack in the gloves from behind me. But what followed wasn't so encouraging. He said, "Well, bowled, Wes, now give the little bastard another one." And, of course, all my plans are out the window now.
When you were first put on a test side, you seemed to struggle at first a bit. Did you put that down to nerves or to inexperience?
No, I think it was lack of confidence as much as anything. Even though I'd made a lot of runs in Shield cricket to get into the Australian side, I'd been playing probably I don't know, about three seasons by then. And a lot of those runs were scored against Test match bowlers. You know, my first Shield 100 was against Davidson and Benno and Martin and Misson, which was almost the Australian attack. So I knew I could get runs against Test bowlers, but I hadn't convinced myself that I could make runs in Test cricket. And so that took a little bit of doing. And I think the first 100 I got in Test cricket was sort of, that's when I decided that, yes, I can play at this level. It's a funny thing. I mean, now they, you know, a lot of young guys play, you know, they'll go on academy tours or Australia A tours and they play overseas. So they're well and truly accustomed to different conditions and all that sort of, which is a terrific. That was probably the only part of my cricket education where I think I missed out. The rest of it was, you couldn't get a better cricket education. But I think the ones that the current players get, you know, where they do so much travelling before, or they might even play a few one-day games before they actually get in the test side. So they're, you know, they've got the feel of what international cricket is all about. I didn't have that feel or the confidence for a while.
You started to negotiate when it came around to the 1970, I think it was, started to negotiate for better pay for your fellow cricketers. Mm. What was the life of a cricketer like in those days? What kind of pay were you getting?
Well,
by our standards today, roughly, you know.
I mean, well, yeah. I can tell you exactly. We got, when I started, my first test was 64, so it was still pounds. We got £200, and they were pretty smart, the board, and they obviously realised that cricketers are pretty dumb, because when it went to decimal currency, we got $200. So they probably thought, oh, the players won't notice the difference, you know.
Well, they halved your money, in other words.
Well, in fact, it probably wasn't, yeah, in those days, because I think I remember at some point around about that time the Australian dollar was equal to the English pound, so okay, we probably weren't getting half, but you can bet your bottom dollar they weren't paying us more. Yeah. So, and for instance, the 1972 tour of England, which was 5.5 months, we got $2,300. Now, I was fine, and about two or three other guys were fine, because we were getting paid from work. But most of the guys had to make do with that money. They weren't getting any pay from work, and some of them even had a wife and kids at home. So they had to send some of that money home. So it wasn't great. I mean, it was a very easy decision to retire when I first retired, because I was getting $200 a day for a test. $200 a test pay. And when I stepped into the commentary box, which is a hell of a lot less dangerous than being out in the middle, I got $200 a day for commentating. So it was an easy decision.
You mentioned a lot of the players there who had day jobs in those days. Do you think that was good for the players?
It was terrific. All of the players had day jobs. I think it was terrific.
Why?
Well, because you were out there mixing with the public. You got to, and you, I mean, as a cricketer, it was very good, because you got definite reality checks quite regularly. I mean, I was a representative for chocolate manufacturer first, and then for a tobacco company after that. And you'd be calling on your clients, and you know, all the district scores were in the paper every Sunday morning. So, you know, a number of times you'd walk into the shop, and the shop owner would say, "Well, you can't be much of a cricketer. Why's that?" "Well, see, you got a duck on the weekend. So-and-so got you out for naught. You can't be that bloody good if you can't make any runs in district cricket." So, you know, it was very good. Whereas now the guys, and also the other thing that was, I think, was very good for us, we used to have Sunday rest days during test matches at home, but also on tour. So on a Sunday, you'd go out and play golf. Let's say if you're in England or South Africa or Caribbean, you'd go and play golf, and you would go to a local club and you would join in and play with some of the members or whatever. And then they'd invite you to, you know, a barbecue that night or to their house. And so you were mixing with people, and you were finding out about other cultures and so on. It was a pretty good education for life.
You tried to negotiate for money with Don Bradman, who was on the board at that point. You were such different figures, weren't you? Like, Bradman was kind of a figure from Menzies Australia. You were more from Whitlam's Australia. You were very different kind of figures in your approach to everything, I think. And how did that go with you, negotiating with a figure like Bradman over better pay for the players?
Well, I made the big mistake of assuming, and as an old boss, David Hill of Channel 9, told me, you never assume, because it's the mother of all stuff-ups, yeah, you know. And but I assumed on this occasion, because I was a kid who knew about the history of Australian cricket a lot because I'd been told a lot, and also because my grandfather played with Bradman and my father played club cricket in the same team as Bradman. So I knew a lot about Bradman, and I knew that he'd had problems with the board when he was
playing. He'd be a player's advocate then.
Yeah, and also, more importantly, one of the problems that he had with the board, one of his major problems, was over money. So I'm going to visit Bradman thinking there'll be some empathy here. And I got anything else but, you know, I've described it as, I felt like I walked in, when I saw him in his office in Perry Street, I felt like when I walked out of there, I thought to myself, Ian, did you just walk in there and put your wallet on the table and say, here, Don, fill that up with money? You know, that's how he made me feel. The board meeting we had, I met with the board twice. The first time I just spoke to the board. And Richie Beno asked me afterwards how it went, and I told him what happened. He said, Ian, if you don't mind me saying so, next time you go, put all your points in writing and a copy for every member of the board plus one for the secretary. He said, because if you do that, then it's got to go into the minutes of the meeting. He said, but if you just speak, they can put in whatever they want and, more importantly, leave out what they don't want. So I did exactly what Richie told me. So all the board members knew the points that I was going to make. And points number 5 and 6 were about finance. And Bradman was sitting on my right, and he was leaning back in his chair, not interested in the first 4 points. As soon as we finished point 4 and the chairman said, what's your next point, Ian? I saw him sit bolt upright in his chair, and I made the point, no, son, we can't do that. And away we go with this harangue of why we couldn't do it. Same with point number 6. When I finished that and went to point number 7, Bradman slumped back in his chair and didn't seem to be particularly interested in the rest. So that was the sort of, yeah, everything. The first thing he said when I put forward, you know, any conversation about money was, no, son, we can't do that. And then it went from there.
Made captain and in controversial circumstances. And you weren't happy about the way you were made captain, were you? It's kind of an unusual situation for you. Did you feel like you were in a bit of a bind over that, Ian?
It was an interesting situation. I mean, they sacked Bill as captain.
Bill Laurie.
And they did it not in the middle of a series, but right near the end of a series, which was unheard of. You know, usually if captains got the push, it was at the end of a series.
It was a mess, wasn't it? I mean, they humiliated him unnecessarily.
And the thing that really got at my nose mostly, because, I think Bill had sort of run the end of his race as a captain, really, as a person playing under him, but certainly not as a player. But what really got up my nose was the way they did it. You know, he heard it, Keith Stackpole heard it on the radio and went into Bill's room and told him that, mate, you've been sacked. And Bill had given great service, and he was a tremendous player, Bill Laurie, and don't believe everything they say about him being a slow scorer. He wasn't. He was a damn good batsman, bloody fine batsman. Anyhow, I thought he deserved to be told face-to-face by the selectors, mate, we're sacking him. But they didn't. And I remember when I came home, I said to my wife at the time, I said, those bastards will never get me the same way. And it was...
What do you mean?
They were never going to... I was always going to retire from the captaincy before I was sacked. That was probably quite a driving force in being captain.
Nonetheless, you were captain. And was that in any way the fulfilment of a boyhood dream? Had you ever had that ambition as a kid to become captain of the Australian side?
Strange thing happened to me when I was about 16. They used to have a schoolboys tournament in Adelaide over the Christmas holidays. And so you play, I don't know, about 15, 16 matches. And at the end of that, they would pick a squad and you'd go and train. And you'd have a lot of the state players and former test players and so on would come along to the coaching and give you advice. And at the end of these couple of days, they would then pick 2 teams from the squads and you'd play a game against each other. So it was quite it was an honour to get picked in these things. Anyway, I was picked in this squad when I was 16. And Jeff Noblett, who was a very fine South Australian fast bowler, played about 3 tests for Australia. He actually took us up to the dressing rooms at the Adelaide Oval. We used to practice out the back at number 2, and then he took us to the dressing rooms at Adelaide Oval. And he took us in and he showed us all around and he said, right, now... He said, I'm going to walk you down the stairs as you would walk out onto the ground as a player. And he said, I want you to think about what you would like to do. I think he probably said cricket, not in life. I think cricket. And he said, then I'd like you to write it on a piece of paper. And for some reason or other, because I'd never, even though I had a grandfather who'd captained Australia, never thought about it. Anyhow, for some reason or other, I wrote on this scruffy bit of paper, Captain Australia. Put it in my wallet and didn't think another thing about it. And when I got the phone call, I was in a pub having a counter lunch in Adelaide, and Alan Shiel from, he was with the News, I think, in those days, he rang me and he said, "Congratulations, mate." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "You're captain of Australia." And I said, "You're bloody joking, mate." And he said, "No, you're captain." And I remember not long after that, I suddenly thought, well, oh, I wonder if that bit of paper... And I opened up my wallet and that little bit of paper was still in the wallet. I think I screwed it up and threw it away.
Oh, no. Did you really?
Yeah.
What a terrible thing to have thrown that away. I mean, that's an extraordinary artifact now. What a shame.
Yeah, I'm not one for keeping things. I mean, I kept my jock strap, my box, and six pairs of County Grey socks when I retired, and that's all I kept.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online and podcast.
Ian Chappell is with me today. He's written a book called Chappelli, Life, Larrikins and Cricket.
I think you said before you became captain, you used to chafe at the demands from authority figures. You know, I'm the boss, do as I say, that kind of thing. How were you as a boss yourself, as the captain? Did you demand that kind of respect yourself? How did you manage that?
Yeah. Well, you can only earn respect, Richard. That's the only way. Well, unless you're Aretha Franklin, you can sing about it. But
very good.
But yeah, really, that's the only way to get it is earn it. And the Australian system is a good system because, you know, Australia picks 11 players, and then out of that 11, they pick a captain. Whereas England at times have picked the captain and then picked the other 10. And I like the Australian system because you've earned your respect as a player. Hopefully you've earned your respect as a person. And then if you get the captaincy, you've got to maintain respect as a player and keep playing well and as a bloke. But then you've got to, again, earn respect as a captain. I read... You know, some stage or other when he took over the captaincy, Kim Hughes said, "Oh, you can't be one of the boys and be a captain of Australia." And I say, "Codswallop, Kim, you can be." Because I think the way I looked at it was, you know, I'd be drinking with Marsh and Walters and Tabor and all those guys. Suddenly I take over the captaincy and what? I don't drink with them anymore. And they're going to say, well, you know, what's this bloke, what's he think? He's too big for his boots now.
Yeah, you're not authentically yourself then, are you?
Exactly, yeah. So, but I felt that, you know, if you earned their respect, they knew when they could take the mickey out of you and treat you as one of the boys, but they also knew when you were the captain and you were giving orders that had to be followed. Mind you, they didn't take them, you know, unquestioningly. If they disagreed with what I said, they told me very quickly and in quite forceful terms. And I mean, I learnt a lot about captaincy. I mean, a classic example, we were playing at Old Trafford in 72. So it was really my second test as captain, actually. I'd captained against the rest of the world, but they weren't test matches. And I'd only captained South Australia, I think I'd captained South Australia, I don't know, four or five times before I captained Australia. Anyhow, it was a really green seeming pitch at Old Trafford, and I wasn't fielding at first slip, I was fielding at mid-wicket for the spinners. Johnny Gleeson was bowling and John Inverarity. Anyhow, as we're crossing over, Rod Marsh came past, and I can't exactly repeat what he said, but he said, "You're a bloody idiot," you know. I said, "What, something I said to you in the bar last night?" "No, no, no." He said, "This is the greatest seamers' paradise, and you've got a spinner bowling at each end." He said, "Get them off and get the seamers on." And I said, "Well, I will remind you, Rodney, that one of those spinners has just got Jeff Boycott out." But, you know, I sort of took it, and I thought about it afterwards, and I thought, "Ian, you're captaining every game as though you're at the Adelaide Oval. You know, every pitch isn't the Adelaide Oval. You've got to captain according to the conditions." So, you know, having these guys who would tell you very quickly what they thought of you as a person or you as a captain, you know, I learned a lot about captaincy from that.
I don't know. I know you're a baseball fan, so I suspect you've seen the movie Moneyball that came out last year.
Yeah.
And there's this great scene where this new guy, the stats guy, is wondering how you tell a player he's sacked.
Mm.
And Brad Pitt says, "You just got to tell him. You don't try and dress it up. You don't say, 'Oh, we really respect you. We don't know.' You just got to go, 'Come in, sit down. You're being transferred, or you're being moved on.'" Mm. And they take a guy will take that news better than trying to say, "Oh, we value your contribution to the game. However, we've decided to for bet yada yada yada." Is that your experience?
Billy Bean was the actual bloke who did it. Brad Pitt played his part. Yeah, I had to drop Doug Walters for the fifth test of that 1972 series. And Doug Walters was, still is, a great mate of mine.
You're very fond of him.
Yeah. But, you know, he had to be dropped. I mean, he wasn't making any runs, and he understood that. And I think he helped win us that test match, that fifth test match. And it was actually, it was a historic moment, actually, because it was the first time ever an Australian side played a test match without a New South Welshman in the team. Anyhow, he took the mickey out of our manager and made this really hilarious speech at the team dinner that night. And I'm sure we all felt we're going to win this one for Doug. So he played his part, even though he wasn't in the game, he played his part. But
how did he take it when you told him, though?
Well, I went up to him. Normally, you would just read the team out at the team dinner. Say, this is the 11 and bad luck, mate, you've got the 12th man's job. But I thought I owed it to Doug, both as a mate and what he'd contributed to Australian cricket. So I pulled him aside and just told him. I said, mate, sorry, you're not playing tomorrow. And he was a realist, Doug, and most cricketers are realists. That's why they accept being told face to face that you're gone. I remember when I got into television commentary, Keith Stackpole was one of the Channel 9 commentators, and I mentioned David Hill before. He was our producer.
Head of sport at 9, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah. He was head of sport. Terrific head of sport.
Different David Hill from the David Hill
around ABC. Yeah, exactly. Hill, And anyhow, Hilly, he wrote Stacky a letter at the end of the season and said, sorry, mate, you know, we're budget cuts and, you know, all the usual things, and this is the reason why you won't be on the commentary team next year, see. So Stacky sent his blazer and tie tack back to Hilly, you see, and Hilly got quite upset about this, and he came to me and he said, what the hell's bloody Stacky on about? I thought we were mates, you know. I said, Hilly, we've all been dropped from cricket teams. We all understand, you know, that at some stage or other, you're going to get dropped, moved on, whatever way. Just all Stacky wanted was for you to tell him face to face. And, you know, it is the best way. I mean, I'm not saying it's easy, and I've only ever had to sack one person in my life from a job, and it's probably one of the worst days of my life, but it's the best way to do it.
There's a story you've got about being the captain of, you know, talented, brilliant players like, you know, bowlers like Jeff Thompson and Dennis Lilly. Dennis Lilly wasn't happy with himself and could be quite harsh on himself. Maybe even take that out on you a little bit once. Tell me about how you managed to goad him into staying in World Series cricket.
Well, Dennis wasn't as harsh on himself as Tomo. Tomo, the things Tomo used to say about himself when he was bowling badly, I can't repeat here. And Tomo was ferocious on himself. But Dennis, like all players of that ability, had great pride in what he did. And he had a ankle injury for the first season of World Series cricket, and he didn't perform as well as he thought he should have, and it wasn't up to his normal standard. Mind you, most guys would have been pretty happy with his season. And at the end of the season, we had all got together and we were about to fly back to our individual states, you see, and we were having a drink in what our manager used to call the noise room at the old Melbourne. And because it had a jukebox in it, you see. Anyhow, the jukebox was playing, and Dennis pulled me aside. He said, come here, mate, I want to have a chat. So he chatted away for a while, and sort of mid-chat, I thought to myself, this is sounding very much like a retirement speech. So at the end of it, he put his hand out, he said, shake my hand. And I said, no, I only shake the hands of fast bowlers, not medium paces, you see.
Oh,
And I, you know, I had a fair idea of what was coming, but not anyhow. He's punched me pretty heavily in the guts, you see. So,
well, right there at the jukebox.
Yeah, bang, like that, you see. And then he put his hand out again, and three times that happened. He put his hand out each time. I said,
he's punching you to persuade you to shake his hand.
So maybe I didn't totally have their respect.
So what happened then, though? He's punched
you
twice.
Three times he punches me in the guts, you see. And obviously the next two, I'm a bit more ready for them. And at the end of it, he said, well, stuff you. He said, I'll be back next season and I'll take more wickets than anyone else in World Series cricket. And guess what happened next season? He took more wickets than anyone else. He was a pretty easy guy to motivate, Dennis.
Is that the essence of leadership? Is copping a punch, three punches in the stomach from Dennis Lilly and not hitting back.
Be prepared to put up with a bit of pain. Yeah, that's part of leadership, yeah.
You, as I said, had a central role in World Series cricket, the creation of that. Tell me about the first time you met Kerry Packer, brought into the room with that man.
Well, I'd retired from first class in international cricket. Yep. Mm-hmm. I was playing for North Melbourne in club cricket in Melbourne. And so, but I was still living in Adelaide, so I used to fly to Melbourne, and I'd leave all my cricket gear and a lot, even some clothes, at the old Melbourne hotel. So I used to travel pretty light. And when I got to the Melbourne airport, having flown in from Adelaide, I got the message, keep flying on to Sydney, you've got a meeting with Kerry Packer. It was a message from Austin Robertson, who was, you know, one of the guys involved with World Series cricket. So I had a pair of jeans on, I had a denim jacket, and I had this sort of country and western style shirt, you see. So I walked into Kerry's office in Park Street, and I discovered later on that was his normal pose. He was in his normal pose. He's sitting back in his chair, jacket off, feet up on the desk, shoes off. So he's just got his sock feet on the desk, you see. And I walk in, and it's no hello, how are you, anything like that.
No pleasantries, no.
No pleasantries. No. It was, what are you, some sort of cowboy, are you? And I can't even remember what my response.
So you backfooted straight away.
Well, yeah, he liked to give you a bounce at first ball. He wasn't interested in your technique. He wanted to see how badly you wanted to be there. So he then said to me, all right, who do you want in this bloody team, you know? And I said, well, hang on, Kerry, I'm not captain of Australia. My brother Greg is. And he said, what do you think, this is a bloody democracy? He said, I'm paying the bills. I picked the captain. You're the bloody captain. I said, well, mate, you know, can I at least make a phone call and ring Greg? I don't want a family argument over this. So I rang Greg and he said, oh, mate, he said, it's a bloody awful job. He said, I've been doing it for 2 years. It's a bloody awful job. You can have it. So there were no family arguments. And then the next thing, he showed me a list of who they had signed. He said, anyone not on that list that you want? And I said, yeah, I want Ashley Mallett. I'm not paying that bloody straight breaker, he said. And he then went on about how he didn't think Mallett could bowl. So I'm thinking, this is going to be tough. So I said, all right, can we do a deal? What's the bloody deal? I said, if Mallett can get you out in one over, I said, will you give him a contract? And he thought for a moment. He said, yes, I will. And then he's gone bang, and he's hitting one of the buttons on the console like you've got here in the studio. And this female voice, yes, Mr. Packer, was his secretary. He said, book me into the indoor net, so I'm going to be practicing cricket for the next week. So he immediately went out and started practicing his batting.
He gets a lot of credit, and rightly so, for, the World Series cricket thing was audacious. It also broke apart a smug kind of monopoly, which is always a lovely thing to watch and all those sorts of things. Still, I've had so many stories about him that are along these lines, where there's all this kind of shouting and bluff. And what do you think of that kind of a human being, a character like Packer as a human being, where his emotional range seems to be from simmering resentment to explosive rage? I mean, a man who bullies people relentlessly and inflicts his own inner pain, whatever that was based on other people. Did you see that, and what did you think of it?
Oh, yeah, Kerry could be a bully, but there was another side to him. I mean, he could be very charming, and he had great pride in his product, the Channel 9 product. He, a few things he told me there, he had enormous pride in that. His two great loves as far as sport were concerned were rugby league and cricket, and we always called him the executive producer, and we used to say, I think it helped me as a commentator, knowing that Kerry was listening at the other end.
Oh, yeah. I don't think anyone did that. And he has a great talent for that. Yeah, he knew what Australians wanted to watch on TV. Yeah. Still, doesn't he strike you as an extremely strange human being that you should always have those kinds of conversations with people? And the veneration is in which he's held for a man who was quite often a bully, would throw cricket balls at his underling's head, that kind of thing.
I mean, I understood that he was a bully, but I think I always felt that, certainly when we were talking on cricket terms, I felt that I had a bit of an advantage. Kerry didn't.
Did you see him as a friend, or would you as someone you liked?
Yeah, I mean, there were things, a lot of things I liked about Kerry. There was the other side of it too. But I mean, you'd say that about everyone that likes and dislikes. But he had albeit a very black sense of humour. But he had, he had a sense of humour. Peter Feynman, famous as a director and
producer,
he was involved with the Croc Dundee movies with Hogan and Cornell, but a greatly admired producer around Channel 9, and he went to Kerry's. He was in Melbourne, and he went up to Kerry's office in Park Street, had a meeting with Kerry, and he, what do you want, son? And Peter said, oh, I want to leave, Mr. Packer, and he said, what do you bloody want, son? You want more money? I'll give you bloody more money. He said, no, I don't want more money. And he said, what do you bloody want then? You want a bigger title? I'll give you a bloody bigger title. He said, no, I don't want a bigger title. He said, oh, I feel so bad that I've come here now. He said, I feel like I could kill myself. And he pulled the drawer out, and he pulled out a gun, and he handed it to Peter. He said, I can bloody fix that too. And he handed him the gun.
Oh, my God.
But that was Kerry's sort of sense of humour. And as I say, you understood that there was, you know, there was a fair amount of bullying. But when you saw the other side, and I don't think they showed the other side of him, really, in How's That?
After leaving cricket, you became a commentator and a journalist. It's an interesting thing, that shift in role, isn't it? Because you've got the same set of data in your head, essentially, as you would as a captain or as a player, but you've got to put it to a completely different kind of use. I notice you're a very disciplined commentator, actually. I can see you're commentating on your brother in the past, as you've commented on his play, and you call him Greg Chappell. You're kind of quite proper like that. What are some of the rules you set for yourself as a commentator?
Well, I think playing cricket, and certainly as a batsman, is probably the best training for cricket commentary, because I've always said that you, if you lose concentration as a batsman, then you'll make a mistake. If you make a mistake, you generally get out. If you lose concentration as a commentator, you'll make a mistake, make enough mistakes, and you'll get the punt there. So it's very good training. As a captain, you're doing a lot of interviews when you're playing, and that, I think, also is not bad training for, you know, when you become a commentator. And then I think the other training is actually watching sport on television or listening to sport on radio. I mean, we have the situation at home now where I'll say to Barbara Ann, you know, do you want to watch this, whatever it is, some sporting event? And she'll say, are we going to have their commentary or are we going to have yours? Because if we've got yours, I'm not listening. But, you know, I listen to the stuff and I think, you know, I hate that. I hate barracking. I hate a commentator who barracks and, you know, when he says we, you know, or us, you know, meaning the Australian cricket team, it gets right up my nose because I think it should be part of your CV, impartial broadcaster. That's what you should be. And I've always described it as, you know, I say that I like to knock on the door and be invited into the lounge room rather than barging through the door. So those are just a few of the rules that I sort of have.
Have you noticed the way sports journalism has been changing in the last 10 years? It's becoming more like political journalism. And before sports people or players tend to get punished more if they talk out of turn. And it's so I tend to find I'm seeing at the moment in most sports journalism the interaction, the interviews that are happening between players, they're being media trained so they don't make a gaffe, and it's getting duller. Have you noticed that too?
Oh, yeah. I did an interview with Ricky Ponting from a newspaper column a few weeks ago, and at the end of the interview I said, thank you very much for your honesty, Ricky. It was an absolute pleasure to talk to the guy and hear a guy who was actually telling me something and, you know, it was informative for me, so I figured that the people reading it was going to be informative. What amuses me is, you know, all the sporting bodies, you know, there's a press conference for everything. You know, if the sun comes up in the morning, oh, we'll have a press conference, you know. And so the players are forced to go to all these press conferences more and more. And I remember Adam Gilchrist years ago, he was at a press conference that I think they were the Australian Cricket Board back in those days, had called. And somebody asked him about Murali, and he said, well, I think Murali chucks in the press conference. And he copped all sorts of flack. And I'm thinking to myself, well, so what are you've made Adam Gilchrist go along to that press conference. And so what do you expect him to lie or to just give, I've got no comment on that. So what's the point of having the press conference?
Yeah, he didn't obey the rules, did he?
Yeah.
Which is you've got to be media trained and you've got to give bland answers, which is, well, you know, well, we see how it goes and I don't know, we're taking it game by game. This is where we are now.
Well, it drives you mad listening to it, or it drives me mad, and obviously it drives you mad as well.
It's why I don't have a lot of politicians and sports people on the program unless they've retired and can speak their mind and speak more candidly because, you know, they can get more punished if you talk out of turn.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I started writing in about 1973, started writing newspaper columns and then magazine columns. And I was still playing in those days. And it wasn't, you know, they weren't over keen on having people write, but they sort of agreed to it. But obviously I knew that they were going to be following everything I wrote. And I didn't find it difficult to write stuff. You know, I wasn't sort of saying this bloke can't bat or that bloke can't bowl, but I was writing stuff about the game of cricket that I thought would be interesting to the public and be informative to the public. Were there, and I never had one query from the Australian Cricket Board, and I'm sure they would have been, you know, knowing my reputation and knowing how they felt about me, that they would have jumped on me the first opportunity they got, and not once was I spoken to. So, you know, you can do it. You've got to think about it a bit.
Perhaps an interesting contrast was the underarm bowling incident where where Greg, your brother, ordered your other brother Trevor to deliver that underarm bowl. Mm. And later on, you wrote in a newspaper column critical of that decision. Yeah. And, you know, you sorted it out with Greg, I think. Yeah. You know, that was okay. But, you know, if that had happened today, you know, brothers at war, you know, that would have been a real absolute beat up.
Well, I mean, I don't know how we'd cope with it if we'd had the training that you get now. And but, you know, there's never been a great problem with Greg and I. I mean, we've had our arguments, run-ins. I mean, it's pretty easy to know where you stand, because once I've got Greg's finger in my chest, I know I'm in big trouble. And I've never won an argument with Greg ever in my life. I mean, he's a foot taller than me.
In your book, you actually reveal an interesting little story about what happened in the dressing room after that underarm bowling incident.
I mean, it's so typical of Doug Walters. I mean, there's always a cricketing logic behind everything he says, but sometimes you've got to search for it. But you can imagine what the Australian dressing room was like after the underarm. Now, they're down in the bowels of the MCG. And, I mean, Australian dressing rooms are never quiet. You know, they're untidy and noisy usually. But here, it's been drop silent in the dressing room for about 10 minutes or so. And suddenly there's this Dougie taking the top off a can, you see, and he has a swig, and he said, I don't know what all the fuss is about. And, of course, Rodney...
Well, it's war with New Zealand is being contemplated at this point, yes.
Yeah, Biggie Muldoon came out and said, no wonder they were wearing yellow because they're cowards, you know.
Oh, yes.
So it was pretty strange. Yeah. Anyhow, Rod Marsh jumps all over him and said, you bloody idiot, we've just bowled an underarm. What are you talking about? You know? He said, well... You know, I still don't see what the problem is. Oh, he said, mate, we stopped New Zealand hitting the ball for six by rolling it along the ground, last ball. He's another sip, and he said, well, he could have hit it for six. How could he hit the bloody thing for six? It's rolling along the ground. Simple, mate. He says, you just put your foot down like that. The ball hits the side of your foot, pops up in the air, and you whack it for six.
Is that legal?
Well, someone did say to him, you could get LBW. He said, no, you get your foot outside the line. But then you know, Rodney said, well, okay, smart Alec, you can do that, could you? Yeah, I can do that. So the next game was at the SCG, and in those days, the nets were out on the number two ground at the SCG. And they had this high, you know, like 10-foot-high brick wall around the SCG. Kim Hughes rolled one along the ground. It's the only time Doug ever went to the nets outside of official practice. Rolled the ball along the ground. Doug put his foot down, popped up in the air. And not only did he hit it over this 10-foot-high wall, he hit it over Driver Avenue, out into Moore Park, and it landed in Kippax Lake out in the middle of the lake. And then he just put the bat under his arm and went back to the dressing room, probably pulled out a pack of cards and a cigarette.
Made his point.
Exactly.
Made his point. Yeah.
You've
got a story in your book about how you went on not just one but several runnings of the bulls in Pamplona in Spain. We're going to be here all day asking why. I know, but I'm guessing it's because it was been an unusually intense experience for you. The first run, you didn't see all that much. What happened in the second run when you decided to join that running of the bulls?
Well,
take us through your eyes.
Well, the problem for me was that I wanted a bit of information before I ran, you know, because this is damn dangerous, this thing. You see? So you're asking all the guys who have run before and, you'll find out. I said, well, I don't want to find out with a horn up my backside, you know. No, you'll find out. So we went on this run and I was with a guy called Bruce Clark who'd run around about 100 times, you see. So I thought, oh, well, I'll go with Clarky because he survived 100 runs. It's got to be good. Anyhow, I think he went about 2 yards and he fell down, and then he ran about another 5 yards and he fell down again. And, you know, that was a disaster. And then I think I went again the next time, and I was told that was the one bit of information I was given was count the bulls and the steers as they go past you. And I sort of hadn't worked out why, but on this run I worked out why. We're charging along this, you imagine, there's thousands of people in the street, and suddenly They just disappeared. I didn't know where they went. And here's this guy getting gored in the leg by a bull, you see. And he was, the bull was about sort of 15 metres from me, and the bailout point over the fence was about 20 metres.
So you're in this, what, a street or a corner or a square or something?
It's just a street. It's a cobblestone street.
And so there's no one there now except you, a bull, and a guy who's been gored.
Gored, yeah. Well, and there's a few other brave souls who are trying to get the bull away by putting this newspaper under his nose. So I thought, I looked at the bailout point, I looked at the bull, and I thought, no, that mightn't be a smart idea. So I turned and charged back up the street. And then I discovered where everyone else is. The ones who hadn't clambered up the wall like Spider-Man, they're heading the other way. So I go this way, and suddenly they all disappear again. And there's another bull up there. Oh, this is, because there was no bailout point that way. So I turn around and go back the original direction, and unfortunately, the guy hadn't listened to the rules. He'd got up and the bull had gored him again and had him up against the wall. So I went straight over the fence and into the Lumumba Bar. And, I mean, the classic...
over the fence and into the Lumumba Bar.
Yeah, the Lumumba Bar was where they serve these brandies and chocolate milk. And
my word, you'd need one of those after seeing that. Did he survive? Did this guy survive that incident?
Yes, he did. He was in intensive care for about 4 days. But, well, I'm relying on other people's information because it was all in Spanish and I don't read it.
It's been wonderful having you on the program. There's many, many stories. Perhaps you've come back on the program one day and tell us some more extraordinary stories, which we didn't have any time to get to today. But it's been lovely having you on the program.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.